Welcome along to this latest Fraser of Allendar podcast. My name is Graham Roy and I'm Director of the Institute. I'm delighted that joining me today to talk about COVID and the business environment is Callum Patterson. Now, Callum will be well known to many of you as Managing Partners, Scottish Equity Partners, one of the UK's leading investors in high growth technology businesses, and has been working and investing in high growth companies for around 30 years. But most importantly, and alongside all his other successes and achievements, he's a proud alumni of the University of Strathclyde. Welcome along, Callum. It's great to have you join us today.
Thank you, Graham.
Okay, so if I could perhaps start with a nice easy one, and which is to get your take on the current economic and business environment. And in all your years of investing, have you seen anything like the scale of the shock that we're seeing, but also the rapid transformation that many businesses are going through as they respond to the crisis?
Well, I think the simple answer to that, Graham, is no, I haven't seen anything like this before. But obviously, the business context is closely related, correlated to the economic context. And the shock to the economy has been unprecedented. But it's also unsurprising, given that large parts of the economy have effectively been closed down. And what we've seen in terms of a fall in production, in services, in construction output is way in excess of what we saw during the financial crisis back in 2008 and the subsequent economic downturn in 2009. So a huge and unprecedented shock, I think, to the economic system. Of course, shocks like this and off the scale are really in coming two types. One is internal, when that might be caused by asset price inflation or a major change in the supply and cost of a critical commodity or systemic failure. The second category is external, and that might be natural disasters or conflicts between countries or even revolutions. The global financial crisis, of course, was essentially an example of an internal shock. This fundamentally is an external shock. And I think therefore to assume that the events that followed an atypical internal economic shock apply to what was a really abnormal external economic shock, I think that's almost certainly wrong in terms of an assumption. For business, there's been as huge an impact as the economic data would suggest. Some sectors such as hospitality and retail, leisure, aerospace, construction and manufacturing have been especially badly hit. But of course, there's a lot of interconnectedness in the economy, and so lots of other businesses have been caught up in this too. And there's a fair amount of sectoral variation. Other sectors have been less impacted. It's also likely that there's been significant variation from company to company, depending on their own precise circumstances. Inevitably, though, I think those parts of the economy that have been hardest hit in the last few months will be the ones that find it tougher to deal with the inevitable aftershocks of this crisis. In terms of our portfolio, just to give you some context and perspective, we currently have 23 high growth companies with around 6,300 employees, aggregate revenues of around about £1.5 billion. The companies are all technology-based, and in the main, they've been fairly resilient over the last few months, and in some in areas like e-commerce and enterprise software, servicing sectors like biohealth, some of those companies have actually done pretty well, whether that's been due to responding to changes in consumer behaviour during the lockdown, or just greater demand for some specific services in certain business sectors. In responding to the crisis, we encouraged all of them to focus on their stakeholders in the widest sense, so including their employees, their suppliers, and also the local communities. And we've been very impressed really by how all of them have responded and the commitment of the management teams and the employees. The initial focus inevitably was on staff welfare, working from home, ensuring that the infrastructure is in place to allow businesses to function remotely. There's been a bit of a shift in recent weeks with a gradual return to the workplace for some companies in terms of critical operations and staff who require access to the office. What we've been trying to do, though, is just to ensure that the portfolio companies are as well equipped as possible to manage what is really an extended period of uncertainty. And that includes, I think, guarding against overconfidence, maintaining a highly data-driven approach, being adaptable, and ensuring that they are that they have adequate financial resources. I think that's very important. And in some cases, we've provided additional investment to help them through the crisis. But after that initial phase and the anticipation of further upheaval, I think what we're now seeing is a gradual shift in mindset, and a lot of our companies are starting to think about future opportunities. But there is a need for caution and discipline around this, because there's clearly still very significant uncertainty in terms of the scale and depth and extent of the economic downturn that we face.
And that's fascinating. And you highlight what I think are two really important issues there, aren't there? There's the challenges in the wider economy and at a macro level, and the enormous demand shock, supply shock, financial shock that, as you say, is unprecedented. But then sitting alongside that, you've got the nature of the crisis driving rapid change in business models, whether that be home working, whether that be shifting to digital. And some companies will be able to cope with either one of these slightly better than others. Some will be able to cope with both okay, and some will be under enormous pressure. You mentioned hospitality. It's an area which gets hit both sides, doesn't it? It gets hit on the economy side, but then also gets hit on the ability to change its way of operating. And do you pick up, I mean, and looking forward, much sense of appetite within the business community to think about these new ways of working, and whether it be flexible working or investment in digital? And it'd be good to get your perspective on the outlook for that. But I take on board fully your point about actually avoiding overconfidence, and you know, there's still a significant challenge ahead of us in all of this.
Yeah, there is a significant challenge, and I think one of the key risks facing business and the economy is just the level of uncertainty, which is going to have a big impact, I think, on investment decisions and other business decisions. There's obviously uncertainty with regard to whether there will be further waves, a second wave of this virus. There's a lot of concern over unemployment in major economies. There's a lot of concern, clearly, about the increase in the debt burden amongst SMEs. But I think just fundamentally, there's great concern about the length and depth of the economic recession that we face. I think there is also a risk of an ongoing and sustained suppression in consumer demand due to what's happened in the lockdown conditions and the time that it is going to take to return to some degree of normality. There's also a big liquidity and solvency risk for lots of companies. That's a huge consideration for many of them, I know. But for companies, really, this is a time to reflect on how they interact with all their stakeholders, including, as we were saying earlier, their suppliers and their customers. Rebuild relationships, press the reset button, review your activities. Look after them and try and ensure that these relationships prevail. In terms of opportunities, and I think this is very relevant for businesses in Scotland, the acceleration of the digital economy, as you mentioned, Graham, I think is exactly something that companies in Scotland should be addressing and trying to gain some opportunities from. That's growing at a really very rapid pace now, with a shutdown of the more traditional physical options, if you like, and also a new demographic of online consumer. Limited ability, as we've seen over the last few months, to buy goods and services from traditional bricks and mortar businesses, but also I think just a gradual decline in the reluctance of consumers to go online and to purchase, to transact online. So I think that is a trend that we will see more of. Inevitably, the businesses that will benefit most from all of this will be those that are able to innovate, those that are able to disrupt, and in the final analysis, I think those that can provide the best experience for the consumer. One thing that we've seen, for example, is, as you would expect in lockdown conditions, a significant increase in new interests and activities, whether that's in areas like music or e-learning or crafts or mobile gaming. All of these things have attracted a much greater level of demand, of interest over the last few months. In terms of remote working from home, I think that has the potential to unlock improvements in business efficiency and open up new employment opportunities, and for companies, reducing excess travel time and related disruption, arguably, lower attrition of staff, increased productivity. These are all opportunities as well, I think, for companies and trends that they might want to reflect on. A number of our companies have actually attracted new customers and partners over the last few months because they've had to. And the opportunity there, I think, is trying to turn some of these more recent relationships into longer term relationships. I think for companies, it's an opportunity to do that, to review funding requirements to ensure that they're financially strong, to take off the opportunities that come forward.
Yeah, and it's interesting just listening to you talk there. I mean, even from our experience in the university and the economics department, the challenges that we've had in terms of being able to continue the student experience for our undergraduates and postgraduates, and the shift to online, we've jumped forward maybe 4 or 5 years in terms of our ability to do e-learning relative to where we were prior to all of this. Now, that's an enormous challenge in there, but there's also an opportunity there. So we've been much more innovative and thinking about how we can be more disruptive to traditional teaching models and give the best experience for the students. But it's not easy. It's quite interesting just how challenging it is to turn all of this around really quickly. And we're a big institution with lots of resources and skills at doing this. So you can see the challenges for individual businesses pivoting on all of this is really quite large. And I've struck by another point you mentioned there about the importance of stakeholders and businesses reaching out to stakeholders. Because I guess from a business side of things, so many of the businesses that have maybe scaled back operations, it will be only when the support networks start to lift and we start to unlock the economy that a lot of the risks that we've seen in the economy actually crystallize. So supply chains will be broken, customers will be in different parts of it. So there'll be that agility and flexibility you talk about will be crucial, not just now, but actually when things start to recover again, and that importance of being resilient through that. Great. So, well, one of the things just building on that is that we've heard a lot in various commentary discussions about how business and society will be transformed by this crisis. So touch wood, once we get through and out the other side, we'll come into like a new normal. And it'd be interesting to get your perspective from you know, the businesses that you look at and the kind of wider business environment about in what ways you think that could change. We touched on them already around flexible working and digital, but also what do you think should change? So from more a subjective view about how you think we might do things differently in a post-COVID world, and also potentially correct some of the challenges we had in the run-up to this crisis.
Well, Graham, that sounds quite like an economics exam question at Strathclyde. Yes, I mean, I think a lot of discussion on the post-virus society and economy and the model that fits best for that. And we keep hearing the words, nothing will be the same again. They've been deployed frequently over the last few months, and I'm sure they'll have many more outings in the months ahead. And of course, for families throughout the country that have been caught up in this terrible pandemic, very sadly, that is true, that things won't be the same again. I think at a broader level, history suggests that these words might actually be too sweeping. If you take the two world wars, for instance, as precedents, you wouldn't get to that result. Life in 1924 was in some ways quite similar to life in 1914. There was probably much about UK society and the economy in 1949 that would have been very familiar to someone who'd been an adult in 1939. And these two wars lasted much longer than this crisis is likely to, with much higher numbers of fatalities, which also, in contrast to the current crisis, were disproportionately amongst the comparatively young. So I think there is a risk of exaggeration. As we touched upon earlier, there's been a lot of talk about the demise of the office. And it's true that in many instances, and certainly in the case of my own firm, teams have found operating remotely has not been as difficult as they might have imagined. But I think it's one thing if you have already acquired the knowledge, the skills, the culture required to be effective in a remote setting, having initially engaged in an office environment and socialised with each other, but quite a different thing altogether for a set of relative strangers, for instance, even with the same talents, if they haven't already connected in the office. I don't think that would be as efficient. So while remote working will continue to increase, and this is a trend that was already underway, it will probably remain most appealing for micro businesses and under very specific circumstances. I also think that it's less clear how much of the significant political, economic and social change that will follow this, how much of it will be completely original. History, again, would suggest that a crisis like this tends to accelerate trends that are already underway rather than create completely new ones. I mean, the immediate legacy of World War One was in the UK certainly, was universal male enfranchisement and a partial move to female suffrage and also Irish Home Rule. But all of these things had been underway before hostilities started in 1914. And they may well have come to pass anyway in the 1920s, albeit perhaps at a slower pace. And the same is true after the Second World War. After it ended, we saw an enhanced role for government in the management of the economy, the creation of the NHS, the introduction of the welfare state. The latter two ideas, of course, had been around. They weren't complete novelties. And as an economist, you'll know that Keynes's general theory had been published back in 1936. In terms of where we are today, I think it's clear that the state is going to play a greater role in the economy, even if the proportion that it controls doesn't increase dramatically. And that's something that's already happening. I think it's also likely that interest rates are going to remain far lower for far longer than anyone would have thought of previously. And the government's going to be concerned about debt, not just in its own accounts, of course, but in the economy more generally.
Yeah, and we've seen extraordinary amounts of government support in the midst of this crisis. I mean, who would have thought the numbers last week, 600,000 people in Scotland furloughed, in the sense of being paid significant amounts of their wages by the state. And you know, enormous capital, about liquidity injection, more from the Bank of England, you know, various other policy measures. We could almost call it like policy whack-a-mole, where something popped up, the government just threw resource at it. But you're right, this is an extraordinary amount of debt can be built up at the end of this. So one of the things that we're thinking about is, okay, so we get through this with this significant government support, but what happens next? So how do you start to unwind it so you can continue to support businesses? But also, where might policy go in the future to help support a more dynamic, growing Scottish economy?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think in the same way that it was arguably easier to put society into lockdown than it has been to get us back out, I think there's a similar challenge for business, actually. Long, hard, complicated, expensive, and involving lots of trial and error. And that's, you know, absent a vaccine or antibody tests at scale. I think the recovery, actually, in that sense, is likely to be more akin to volume control than an on-off switch. But at the heart of this, of course, there's some pretty important policy questions, including how we recapitalise the economy when it's got unprecedented levels of debt, and how does the economy actually recover? What's been done, as you said, Graham, through government intervention, through the various support mechanisms, has been unprecedented. Perhaps not fast enough for everyone's liking, but it's been done at what for government is really breakneck speed. The job retention scheme is obviously the most significant intervention, but there have been a whole series of other initiatives, including the two coronavirus business interruption loan schemes, the Future Fund, and the Bounce Back loan scheme. And so far, as you will have picked up, we've seen unemployment rise less rapidly in the UK than some other countries. But that's because the support that's been provided here has been focused on wage subsidies rather than increasing out-of-work benefits by much. And yeah, the numbers for Scotland are you know, incredibly high. Across the UK, the job retention scheme has about 9.1 million employees, which is about a third of the working population. We've adopted a similar model to some other countries, including, for instance, Australia. Of course, their workers are allowed to keep doing some work, whereas the initial rules in the UK scheme certainly was that employees had to be furloughed. But the labour market has undoubtedly weakened very significantly. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And what happens to the to unemployment figures when the furlough scheme starts to unwind is really the big question. It's, I think, an evolving picture, and probably too soon to know, for instance, whether the UK's approach to this has been the right one relative to some other countries. But I think what is clear is that if wage subsidies are withdrawn too quickly, or if changes to the structure of the economy mean that pre-coronavirus businesses and jobs can't be resurrected, then many of those who are currently furloughed in the UK, sadly, are going to end up unemployed. And that could end up leaving the UK facing similar levels of unemployment to the likes of Canada, the US and Ireland. In other words, it would have been pain delayed rather than pain avoided. So I think going forward, a lot of consideration will need to be given to how this is phased. The government's already extended the job retention scheme through to October with a tapering off in support levels. But it may need something longer term than that if we're going to avoid mass unemployment. Another concern, of course, is that wage subsidy schemes like the furlough scheme might actually discourage those who have been furloughed or indeed underemployed workers from seeking work in other sectors, perhaps sectors with a brighter future. And that's arguably therefore running the risk of slowing down the usual process by which the labour market reallocates workers to where they're most needed. And these downside risks obviously increase the longer the wage subsidy schemes operate. So I don't think it's going to be an easy balance to strike. We're also seeing that hiring new workers is slowing down. I think companies are not hiring. And I think I read recently that something like 8 unemployed people are chasing every job against, I think, 2 before the virus. And inevitably, the poorer areas will probably be the hardest hit.
The numbers the UK published this week for vacancies are quite extraordinary, just the scale of the collapse in that. And I think you make a really important point about the timing and phasing all of this and the enormously difficult job that policymakers have between when do they start to ease off the support and turn off the support to let the economy start back up, and you're right to reallocate resources around. Do that too early and you run the risk of creating a substantial rise in unemployment, do it too late, and then you potentially build in longer term challenges. But then how do you combine that with the restarting of the economy and the easing of restrictions, and that balance between support, easing of restrictions? And a lot of the smaller companies that we speak to in the various surveys that we do, they're literally talking about having weeks of reserves and weeks of resilience. So getting that right is so difficult, because if you're either side of that, then the exponential hit to the economy could be really quite large. There are a couple of issues that I'd throw into all of that, which are really important around the timing, is obviously the trace, test, isolate system. So getting that up and running effectively so you can properly try and mitigate the worst risks of a second phase. Obviously, confidence, how you can start where possible to try and support confidence in the economy. But then crucially, and obviously quite controversially in the last few days, but around schools, how can you safely start schools at scale to let people with caring responsibilities back out into the workforce? And all of these need to work in order for a safe restart to the economy. And the challenges in there for people to get that right, policymakers, is really difficult.
Yeah, and I think there's also a very close correlation between the position for schools and the economy and business, that ultimately, if children are not in schools, then it's harder for the economy to recover because people find it more difficult to actually go to work. So I do think from that perspective, it's very important, but also for the sake of our children, I think it clearly is hugely important that as many of them as possible return to normal education as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And just one final question. You mentioned about the role of the state potentially being much larger in the economy than it's been in a while. But there's also been some discussions about potentially over the longer term, using the role of the state to potentially invest in different types of recovery businesses to support longer term growth, whether that be for policy objectives such as the green recovery or wider objectives, but also using the resources of government to help support the private sector to grow and develop. And it would just be really interesting to get your take on on all of that. So once we get through this, the role of policy in this new normal to help support business growth.
Yeah, I think another big question from a policy perspective is how do we recapitalise the economy after all of this, given the unprecedented levels of debt, and how do we get the economy growing again? I saw one estimate that there's something like £100 billion pounds of unsustainable borrowing in the UK, and I think it was the new governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, who made the point that while it's good to see all these liquidity measures being used to help companies, through this, what happens if the liquidity crisis turns into an insolvency crisis? I think that was a very good point. Companies that were economically viable and financially viable beforehand might still be economically viable, but they may no longer be financially viable. And I think actually the biggest problems might be at the smaller end. As at the 14th of June, the large CBILS scheme had advanced £1.8 billion to 279 businesses. The smaller CBILS scheme, the number was £10.1 billion to 49,000 companies. But the bounce back scheme, through which the government provides 100% guarantees, that had allocated over £26 billion to 863,000 micro-businesses. And I think it's fair to say that much of this would not have been lent out under normal circumstances. So we are dealing with a pretty extraordinary situation. I think, in the main, larger companies will probably be okay. Quoted companies certainly have access to capital. Medium-sized companies might well be able to attract money from private investors. I think some companies will struggle, though, and that's likely to be at the smaller end. Smaller, but of course, often businesses that are providing very vital services, particularly in a local sense. If the recovery is long and there's a lot of distress, then I think the government will need to look at ways to work around this, whether that's forbearance schemes for some of these loan schemes that have been made available, extending debt repayment terms or perhaps linking repayment to future performance. But in the end, I think the role of government should be to try and catalyse the private sector, not displace it, to try and stimulate activity, to work with it, to try and encourage it to make things happen. And, in terms of future policy interventions, clearly there's been a huge amount of work done on the policy side in a very short space of time. That would be, I think, the way to focus it in the future. And I don't think we're really anywhere close to the end of the story, actually.
Great. And that's been fascinating chatting with you this morning, Callum. Thank you so much for your time. And it's been great seeing you. And hopefully we'll catch up in person very soon. Thank you very much.